So welcome, everyone. Welcome to this Spirituality and Peace series. This is David Nicol, director of the Gaia Field Project. We're co-hosts of this series with the Shift Network Summer of Peace program. Welcome back to those of you who've been following this series. To those of you who are just joining us for the first time, this series is really about creating a space for you to have a direct experience of peace, of the essence of peace, through experiencing the practice of a mystic or spiritual teacher from a variety of spiritual traditions, and being weaved a global field of peace through this series, comprised of the practices of a number of different traditions. And in this way, it's really kind of in global spirituality and what we call global subtle activism. The idea is that the peace that we're building over this northern summer is of benefit not only for us, but also that can ripple out into the world and can support the shift to a global culture of peace. The series will culminate on the International Day of Peace, September 21st, with a Global Attunement for Peace event, which has recently become actually even more exciting because we have partnered up with a group known as MedMob, which convenes large flash meditation mobs in public places in over 380 cities around the world each month. And so on September 21st, they're partnering with us. They'll be doing their public events, and we'll be doing actually three calls, three global attunements for peace to anchor the field on that day. So it's really building up to be quite an extraordinary experience on the International Day of Peace 2012. So we hope you can join us for that event as well. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Myra Jackson, who's going to be the host of the call today, and we'll introduce our guest, Cynthia Bourgeau. Myra is a great friend of mine and a fellow member of our Gaia Field Council. She is one of the founding members of the Zamboling Institute for Human Transformation. She's the host of Gaia Field Radio. And she's really a remarkable Renaissance woman and a dear friend of mine. So over to you, Myra.
Oh, how wonderful it is to be with everyone on this Sunday. For some of you, it's morning. For some of us, it's afternoon. And thank you, David, for that lovely introduction. It kind of took me by surprise. We do have today Reverend Dr. Cynthia Bourgeau. And as you know, during the series, we are here to build the field toward September 21st, that Global Attunement event. And we've had many guests, and today's guest I'm particularly fond of in terms of the body of work and the strength of her practice. Reverend Cynthia Bourgeau is known today by many titles, such as Reverend, Doctor, Episcopalian Priest, Contemplative, Student of Thomas Keating. And each of those titles suggest her various paths of learning, study, and mentorship. However, from her experiential walk, another set of titles emerge to describe Cynthia. The Psalms chanter, and rather a chant master, singer, mystic, visionary, and Christian unitive consciousness teacher. It's quite a mouthful. The bridge between that is integrated through the titles that are more descriptive of her walk as the devoted practitioner who spends time in hermitage, the prolific writer who has brought forward seven books that include a look at Mary Magdalene's apostolic role and Yeshua's wisdom teachings, the teacher and retreat leader who balances her time in the silence teaching, writing, and engagement such as today. For me, I experience another title, and that is one of liberator. For what I experience in her work is that freeing up of the next level of what it means to experience Yeshua as this collective body of which we're all a part. And so as I move to actually welcome Cynthia on so that we can hear from her and experience her energy today in the practice of her tradition, I'd like to take us to the scene of her most recent work in Assisi, Italy, also known as the Christian Dharmasala of today, where she's just finished a body of work where those on retreat with Cynthia and her cohort, Father Richard, where they examine the words of St. Francis as he gave them in San Damiano more than 800 years ago. And I can tell you from that, the work is still reverberating. And so I'd like to welcome Reverend Cynthia Bourgeot on today. Hello, Cynthia. Are you out there?
Hi. Yes, I am out here. And I should tell you, just as just for truth and advertising and a little curveball for everybody, that one of the other roles that I wear and titles most proudly is that of grandmother. I'm the 9-year-old who is spending this week with me in Foggy May and has been instructed that she's not supposed to interrupt the contemplative silence and the patina of the hermit in her hermitage with any loud squawks. But if they're loud squawks, just take it as the fact that life goes on and, hey, there's a new generation, and that's the greatest thing to be thankful for. So I think she's out running around in the fields in Maine, but we shall see. What is the spiritual journey if not surprises? Christian Dharmasala, I kind of came up with that title myself, that I was at the Dharmasala. Of course, many people have been over the years doing the great pilgrimage to that wonderful little city in exile, where His Holiness the Dalai Lama's vision of peace and compassion and kindness and a new kind of human being is being lived so beautifully. And it struck me the first time I went to Assisi that we had something very much like that in the Christian ballpark organically there in Assisi, where St. Francis 800 years ago simply took it upon himself to live the Christ vision without kind of excuses and the usual hypocrisies. And the city is a clear beacon of love, so much so that people have considerably have come back to it, including about 20 years ago a conference of the great religious, the spiritual leaders from all the traditions to come to Assisi, City of Peace. And there this past time I most powerfully saw the need for these places that really are little cities in exile of peace in a broken world to beam out this message and to take advantage of the morphogenetic fields of people who really are concerned that it's time to do something different on this planet.
And in that time, I notice from many of the commentary, and I have been reading, I mean, the internet is alive with people reporting out their experience from that time in May where you took advantage of the energy still present there, the subtle energy present there. And here at the Gaia Field, we are focused on that subtle energy and the power of that in terms of working within that morphogenic field. So tell us more about what you feel is still present there in Assisi itself that we can take advantage of.
Well, what's present there is the love, first and foremost, the deep kind of love and the deep kind of peacefulness that Francis felt towards everything. And what's powerful, what's present there is the witness of peace, according to this very, very kind of what you might call backhanded route that, that Francis discovered, which was trusting in the power of the morphogenetic field itself. You know, part of Francis's, you know, kind of continually frustrating human vision is that everything he tried led to a dead end. And one of the things that we don't really sufficiently know about Francis is that he was the first person in Christianity to go on an intentional international peacemaking mission, to visit with a Muslim, leader to try to bring peace in the Holy Land. And everything seemed to fail on a physical level. He never, you know, he never got to join a crusade. He never got to the peace that he wanted didn't happen out of this. The whole thing ended in a horrifying bloodbath. But on another level, as he grew more and more helpless on one level, he grew stronger and stronger at another level. And I think it's the power of that level, which is approximated and touched by sheer integrity, even in the face of impossible odds, that really resonates with a kind of timeless power. So there's a direct line that Francis magnified with complete purity, the note that was first struck by Jesus. And it allows Christianity to broadcast its deepest and truest message in this profound sympathetic reverberation.
Yes, and so we would find in this, you know, when you speak of this, this leads to another place that you often take us to in your teachings, and that is to the open heart, to the awakened heart, of which St. Francis seemed to have embodied. And there was a certain fearlessness. I know you mentioned the helplessness, but you mentioned how that strengthened him as well. And here today, we are at another intersection where we are growing into an appreciation of a heart because we understand its layer, its power within our own bodies, at a very physical level, up through the subtle level. And, of course, even in this series, we are partnered with the Institute of Heart Math. So it's very much very much a part of the work we're doing in this series is through the, their own global coherence room. And, so this is, you know, here we have a living heart portal in place in terms of Assisi, Italy, where St. Francis lived, walked, and had his being. So the question here is, how much of that can we truly embody and carry into the world as some sort of vessel of peace? What does St. Francis, or what does your practice lead us to? How does it guide us in that?
Well, I think there's an interesting hook to things, and that particularly in my practice, in the part of the Christian path that I live with, it's a part that is in some ways in tension with holding the goal of peace. Because the path that I follow is a path of radical surrender, which is to say that we don't try to approximate peace by juxtaposing it to war and then declaring one is bad and the other is good, but we develop a deeper kind of acceptance which allows us to hold both edges of the paradox at once, without the need to do anything in a physical realm, you know, without the need to exercise the will on the horizontal level. And it's a very, very delicate balance, because if you fall off in one direction, you fall off into apathy, who cares? And if you fall off into the other direction, you fall off into urgency and sort of pushing things around, which is part of the very self-righteous agenda that actually can get in the way of peace. So Francis was a master of this radical surrender, to care and not to care, not to constrict the heart by getting too attached to any specific expectation, but to continue to detach, unattach, let go of those objects of attachment, those objects of fantasy, and those worthy objectives, and to simply be open in the deepest way to the fullness of divine reality, which is always present in paradoxical form at this level of being.
Yes, yes. And, of course, he wasn't there alone. When we think of St. Francis, we can also think of Claire.
Yeah, and there's a deep spiritual companionship there that has been so profoundly captured in poetry and in art, and is out there. You can still feel that resonating around in the morphogenetic field. But this tender relationship between the refusal to exercise the right of willful choice on this axis in order to hold open a field of infinite reconciled possibility on the surrounding and larger axis, the field, is a very delicate place that is really the heart of the Francis path, and I believe the heart of the Jesus path, and the heart of the path that I try to follow myself. It requires courage, but not that kind of blind either or courage, more the kind of courage to live in the very ambiguity of circumstances without needing to collapse the tension by resolving to a dualism.
Ah, yes, yes. And of course, that's a repeating theme as well, as you say. Not defining the act and the activity by what we don't want, of course, but this surrender to the deeper love and moving away from the resistance that keeps us from moving into the depths of love. And this is what the continual returning pattern seems to be in your practice. And this is what you offer.
But it's not so much returning to love as over and against hatred. It's a returning to openness at whatever cost. I love a little quote from Rumi. He says, "Your anxiety comes from your search for tranquility. Accept chaos and peace will surely follow." That's such a powerful benchmark to practice. I mean, there's two ways of restoring oneness. One is the route of visualizing the good, moving for the good, but then you've still got the bad. And what we've discovered, particularly around this heart math finding about the heart and in what state the heart is awakened. The Heart Math Institute really works on negativity will close down the heart. But in a physical sense, no, negativity is really constriction. And constriction occurs when we're hanging on to something, even if it's something that's good. If our consciousness, if our attention is in that hanging on state. So if we're hanging on to peace because we don't want war, if we're hanging on to good because we don't want evil, we're still only holding one piece of the puzzle and we're rejecting the other. And that's sort of physiologically a state of constriction. So the capacity to hold the paradox deeply without preferring one outcome to another at this level is a deeper state of peacefulness, which comes from having the capacity to be unconditionally present with having to push anything around in order to make it okay. And it's this deep, deep, unconditional presence that I think is at the heart of the Christian transformational mystery. Certainly that was what we saw in Jesus on the cross. Certainly that's what we saw being reaffirmed more and more deeply in St. Francis, where all, even his most noble motivations went nowhere. And but yet something emerged, and that something is so powerful and so pristine that you can still feel it throbbing away today as a sort of tonic for this whole torn and broken, polarized planet.
Yes, and what you bring up when you speak of this, what to do with the bad, what to do with the fear, what to do with what is, you know, definitely present in our human experience as we look at the moving into the deeper love or opening to this deeper love, is what it reminds me of is the great lesson I had to learn. And this may be relevant to others who are listening today, since this is a call that's dedicated toward the peace, is that there's that thing out there called that spiritual bypass. And
yeah.
This is that piece that I feel is that we're the edge that we're being asked to hold is to make room, make space for those pieces that we would judge that are less than peace, less than love. Make room for them.
Yeah.
Invite them in.
Yes.
Yes. And
yes,
the,
I agree 100%.
Right. And I know that when I set up in my instrumentation and I was trying to see the coherent pattern, I got nowhere until I began to relax and allow the state I was in to acknowledge it and then to allow that feeling of moving into these, you know, just that allowance alone allowed me to access love and to see that coherent pattern show up. And so this is, you know, this seems to be, it's not we tend to take a parochial approach sometimes, which means out with the bad, in with the good, you know, and we fracture ourselves along the way. And what we do is we lose that energy, do we not? The energy that could be there for the encounter, you know?
Yeah, it's exactly so. Yeah. The egoic version of unity and creating a united field is to eliminate everything that's deemed unacceptable. And the real non-dual access to that is to learn how to widen the field of acceptance so much that so that you don't need to judge some acceptable or preferred or unacceptable, but to simply be present to everything. And then the energy moves, which is love. Because love is, and, you know, this may be a faith statement, but it's also an experience statement. Love is the nature of the universe. Love is the nature of the field that we move in. And it's only our attachments and insistences and urgencies that really disrupt that field. So it's not creating something that didn't exist. It's sort of gradually removing the stuff that's barriers to the reality that is.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Well, here we are at that moment. The time flies so quickly that we have an opportunity to experience your offering in yet another way. And in some way, I know that what we're about to experience is a part of what you offered during the time at Assisi in May most recently. You primarily come out of a silent contemplative practice. And yet we know the baseline of it all, that one of the ways we can experience this life moving and the fluidity of life is in the breath itself. And so I'd like to then transition us into the actual practice, if we can, so that those who are participating with us in building the field today can take something with them in terms of the practice. Can we do that now?
Perfect.
All right. Great.
Yes. And of course, if I was simply in my own niche, I would be, you know, my core practice would be to do 20 or 25 minutes of centering prayer. But that doesn't go well on a phone call, and it's hard. It's really hard to keep the energy of meditation that going that way on a brick phone and Skype network across the world. So I'm going to do a bit of a variant, which moves more in the direction of a visualization, but not much. It's a wonderful practice that's grown up out of this beautiful flowing together of the streams of practice. You might call it a meta-Christian practice, where what we do is basically take the wonderful Buddhist practice of Tonglen, or conscious breathing in of the pain of the world and breathing out of blessing, and add to that the Christian twist of substituted love, which is what Christ practiced on the cross, the willingness to stand in the place of the neighbor, what St. Francis practiced when he was willing to hug the leper at whatever cost to his own being, because you love your neighbor as yourself. So this practice that I'm going to lead you through combines those two streams, which really flow together as one. They're practice of the heart of compassion. So it starts with and it grounds in the most important part, which we're going to do together. I'll walk you through the whole thing, The first stage, we're just going to practice breathing in, breathing out. Then we'll add to that a breathing in of whatever particular situation you're holding in your heart, and a breathing out of blessings. And then in the third, if you want to use it, we will add to that, if you're willing and if you feel moved to do so, the willingness to stand in the place of the one you're holding in that breathing, in that pain. So we'll take about, I think, probably 3 to 5 minutes with each of those phases, and I invite you to do that. Pardon?
All right, that's great.
Yeah, and I thank you. I thank all of the audience out there, and would want you to take stock of yourself as field, as a global field at this point, doing work on behalf of the planet. I actually call this practice cosmic dialysis, because we cleanse the great blood vessels of our aching world and participating in it. So the first step is simply breathing. And I think this is the most important step, and at any time during the time we're working on this meditation together, it is important. If story gets too much in the uppermost, if drama gets too much in the uppermost, if self-importance gets too much in the uppermost, just come back to breathing. Because the breathing is done for you. You don't breathe yourself. You're simply joining a pattern that moves through you as it moves through all things that are alive. And you're letting your head and your heart and your own fevered emotions and your charitable willingness to help, all that talk, you're letting it just fall back into the breathing. So let's begin, and we'll take a few minutes. I'll lead you through it, to just come into connection with your own breathing. And allow it in whatever way is graceful to you to rise and fall and rise and fall. Don't count it. Don't try to artificially hold it or stop it. Just let it come and let it go. And whenever thinking might rise up, or any concern or any image, just let it fall away into the breathing itself. With simple presence. This is a very basic, universal practice done by every religious tradition. So let's join all our spiritual hearts together and breathe together for 3 or 4 minutes. maintaining that strict objectivity of breathing, allow on the in-breath that pain to come in and flow through your own body and being, and on the out-breath to simply let it go. Let it go with blessing, but you don't have to put a blessing there because the letting the go is the blessing. Everything moves. Nothing stays. So allow that. Simply be present to the person, the situation that has come into your heart. Breathe in solidarity with the pain. Breathe out in solidarity with the confidence that all things are moved and refreshed in divine love. And if you find that things are moving to drama, that you lose that steady rhythm of the breathing and become more kind of bound up in the story or the urgency or the wish or the drama, go back to the breathing. This has to be as objective as a metronome for the real work to be done. And we'll do that for another 3 or 4 minutes. And now, if the spirits will move you to take it to this next step, as you continue to hold in your heart that specific person or that general situation, whatever you're working with, add, if you feel like it, the willingness to stand in the place of that person. and very lightly simply imagine yourself loving your neighbor as yourself, taking the place of that person. Only if that seems natural. If it seems forced or if it puts you in fear, return to what you can maintain safely, consciously, and calmly. And we'll do that for another 3 or 4 minutes. That's the substituted love part of this exercise. And now, very slowly and gently, allow yourself to come back, to return to your breathing. And we'll take time just to center in your breathing as I conclude this time of spiritual work together with a chant which comes from a 14th century Christian mystic, Julian of Norwich. All shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, be well. All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, be well. All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, be well. And so let's return. Myra, are you there?
I am. And you're asking me to do a lot to pull myself back in.
Well, you can pull yourself back in slowly. I just wanted to make sure we hadn't lost the phone call into the stratosphere.
No, we have not. We are with you. We are with you. And thank you for bringing the, thank you for bringing the chant in. So let's just allow then for a sitting in this space that has been created for another 3 minutes. And then I'd like to open this up afterwards.
Fabulous. Well, it's over.
Yeah.
Over to you to lead the pacing through all of that.
All right. Very well. And as we just settle into this, those of you participating in this experience with us today, we'd like to open the phone lines to allow you to comment on your experience. And we will also open this up for questions, if you have some specific questions of Reverend Bugeaud, we can accommodate those questions as well in our final moments. So let me let you sit with that. Let's take 2 minutes to do that now. All right, thank you. If you have a question, on your keypad, you can press star 2 to raise your hand. And we will look for you. And it's quite all right if you'd like to just continue in the silence. No pressure to move into, to move at all from the place that you're in. We will just watch out for the raising of your hand and take it as run with that.
I would also just like to add that if you're in the webcast and you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, then you can just put it in the chat box and we'll read out the question.
Beautiful. Thank you for that reminder, David. All right. Cynthia, thank you for that practice. I'd love for us to kind of review the steps in that Tonglen as you shared them. We went through three phases, I believe. And And we began with, can you walk us through those steps once again? The first step being in this.
The first and most important step is the simple breathing. The breathing in and the breathing out, that's the cosmic dialysis I referred to there. And it's really important to reach the point where there's nothing separating you from your breathing. You're not pushing it around, but neither are you covering it up with thoughts or stories or drama. It's the kind of touchstone, the musicians would call it the pedal point that everything else flows on. So the first step is simply to get that. And it's really important to realize, too, that that's the step at which all the work is actually getting done. The next couple of steps may sound a lot more dramatic to our drama-hungry minds, but the real work is done in the breathing. So if you do nothing in the practice but simply breathe in and breathe out, consciously present for the time you're doing it, that's where the work has been done. The divine field will take that generous gift and and use it to the good of all. The second step then is very gently to bring into your heart the Christian terminology that I like best is to lift up in your heart a situation or a person that you want to work with in a particular kind of way during this process. It can be a general thing like, peace in Jerusalem or a war-torn country, or it can be something very personal, a relative struggling with disease or mental illness, whatever. But you allow it to come into your heart. And without any expectation of outcome, you simply enter solidarity. And as you breathe in, it's with a willingness to breathe in the pain or the suffering or the brokenness of that situation. And it's with, and then when you breathe out, it's with a willingness to let go. And I think it's really important to talk about what's important to do and not do in this step. That some people are worried about this because they say, well, we're breathing in toxicity, aren't we? You know, when you say you're breathing in somebody else's pain, yeah. But this is exactly where being absolutely rock solid on the breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out is so powerful. Because it only becomes toxicity if you attach a story to it and then hold on to the story. I'm doing so much bad work. I'm doing so much good work. Oh, the situation is so bad. Oh, I have to help. And then you find you're not letting go. And it's that attachment, even to the good and to the true and to the beautiful, that causes the constriction. So it's letting go. All things come, all things go. And in that is the healing. So you practice the letting go. A lot of people say in that second stage, you breathe in the pain and breathe out the blessing. But we don't create the blessing, and it's egocentric to think that I'm going to send a little bit of my blessing here. The letting go is the blessing. So once again,
yes,
you just allow it to come in, you allow it to go out. And you don't do the work. You simply are gratefully present as the work happens. And then in the third step, which is the conscious placing of the substituted love that you are willing to stand in the place of another, the love your neighbor as yourself. And so that you would, as you breathe in the pain, this works more, of course, better with a specific person than with a general situation. The willingness to take it in takes it in so far that you are willing to stand there. And that's not something to be done if it causes you to lie or to overstate your case spiritually or if it causes fear. It's a place where a natural readiness of love can go if and when it's ready. And again, if there becomes too much drama there or too much fear, if the basic steadiness of the breathing is being disrupted, you move back to the breathing. So that's the three steps.
This is very, very helpful,
imagine,
Cynthia.
Well, that's great, you know. I imagine being a Christian practitioner that's what Christ was doing on the cross, the kind of cosmic tanglin for the whole brokenness of humanity, breathing in our pain and our brokenness and allowing the love that comes from non-attaching to flow through and cleanse all.
Right, and of course, in deferring to that which is the source of the breathing altogether. And what I love so much in what you described, and I appreciate you going back through the steps and adding in the kind of watch outs. And in the watch out here in the third stage, this one is brilliantly stated as that natural readiness and that being aware of not overstating where you are.
Exactly.
That being important because after all, I feel the instruction I'm receiving from you has to do with, whether or not you've been unseated or uprooted from the rhythm of the breathing in and out.
Exactly. And if you have done that, that means that some ego drama has gotten in the way.
I got it. And I thank you for that. We have a question that's come up, Cynthia. One of our questions here is, thank you, Cynthia. It was a beautiful practice. Can you comment about the aspect of Divine Mother, feminine, in your practice and tradition? And he goes on to ask, this is Philip, and the role of the Divine Mother, feminine, in this stage of global transformation.
Well, again, yes, this is, I think that what we're coming to in our own era is an integration of the opposites. And since in so many religions, and particularly in the Western traditions, and Christianity may be right out there in front, there has been the repression and the denial of the feminine, which has gone across the board from our worship to, you know, from our spirituality to our political structures. And so we're in an era of, as we converge on a new, we're in an era of sort of restoring this damage. And so the whole icon of the feminine and the feminine dimension of God and the Great Mother is very, very much out there. But my particular concern is to move beyond the dualism of, you know, well, we have a great father and now we have a great mother, to rejoin the opposites. And the great image in Christianity is of the Christosophia, the unification of the maleness and the femaleness in a truly human being that transcends and includes them both. And that's basically where my practice centers.
Yes. All right. Any other questions along that, feel free to raise your hand. Again, that would be star 2. Otherwise, I'm going to continue with where we have been here with my next line of inquiry. You sang a chant for us. And
yes.
I'd love for you to share with us how that fits into your practice and how it supports the practice of your contemplative.
Oh, well, it supports it 100% because that once again we come right back to the breath, which is the way we live on this planet, and that there's a tendency for things to get much too mental when you're just reading and writing. That when we actually chant, we not only are activating our whole body as an agency of spiritual intelligence, but we're also directly receiving food because reality is vibrational. It makes its way known with us in these little quantum packets of love, of touch, of connectivity that come through vibration. And you can really literally energize your inner being, your subtle energetic system through chanting. So, you know, in Christianity, in classic practice, the monastic traditions always use Gregorian chant, which is extraordinary in those terms because of the purity of the symbol, the actual sounds made, and the kind of breathing patterns which are imposed with the long extended out-breaths as you sing. The Gregorian chant is still around, but it is not as prevalently used in the church nowadays. I have for 30 years chanted the Psalms using the Psalm settings that are in use by the monks of Newcomaldoly Hermitage in Bicester, where I'm an oblate member. That means not an inmate, an outpatient of the monastery. And so I've chanted the Psalms as monks have been chanting them for, you know, nearly 2,000 years, according to the office appointed. When I'm with groups of people, we've been developing a whole set of chants which you would call much more akin to universal sacred chanting in that they're short phrases, repetitive, as I did that all shall be well is just one short phrase that's sung over and over and over, sometimes with harmony. So that's a very key part of my practice as we work, particularly in Christianity, where we're severely remedial here, in learning to embody more deeply and fully at the vibrational level the reality of the divine presence.
it's really interesting how you, of course, went to that piece. And this is the one of the other practices that I feel that we would like to see more of in the Gaia field is the work with sound through chant and other means. And one of the things I stumbled upon years ago that is still waiting for me to pick back up again, and I want to sort of mention it to you in case there's anything else you can add, and that is that some of the old Gregorian chants were seen to really create a vehicle that was elevating and transporting where the other spectrums of color and other levels of vibration became vivid in that space. And there's a huge, I think, opportunity, at least for me, and maybe not huge, no need to overstate it, but there is, I think, something waiting to become visible in this idea of not only looking at the enlightened heart and its potential at this time for us to incarnate, I guess, our sense of divinity, but that there's something in the sound that allows us to become transported.
Oh,
I turn that over to you.
That's
a mess that I've given you, but I turn it over to you in that way.
Well, I'll give you a couple of bibliographical things. The tradition that is probably most thoroughly developed this whole idea and the relationship between sound and color and the transformations that go through them is the Chistia Sufi order with Hazrat Inayat Khan, and that tradition really knows some things about those junction points. But, of course, Gregorian chant is not the native language of that particular tradition. In Gregorian chant, one of the most exciting things that's happening, and I'll put this name out here so you listen to it, there's a fellow by the name of Yegor Reznikov, who's a Frenchman of Russian extraction, who is doing absolutely wonderful work in reclaiming Gregorian chant, but sung in just temperament, which is at the natural tuning of the intervals. We've all been singing Gregorian chant in equal temperament, as we've been singing everything in equal temperament since the time of Bach, which means that all the intervals are sort of falsified so that you can sing in any kind of key. But Yegor points out that in doing this, you lose the power of their vibrational impact. And he's doing revolutionary work teaching people how to sing Gregorian chant with the correct intervals and with the sounds positioned correctly in the body. And I've worked with him long enough to know that it creates an incredible tingle of vibrant aliveness and living connection to this gusher of prayer that's out here all the time that we're clueless about. To sing the chant a microtone off, or to sing it without any conscious reverence for the power, for the digestive power of the syllables themselves, is just to go waltzing along the surface of it without ever falling into the depth. So I think that your instincts are right on. There's a whole new science that's actually been there all along, but has never been talked about, that now people are beginning to have the conceptual maps so they can talk about it.
Yes,
but
and I thank you so
much. Pay attention to Yegor Reznikov. He's one to keep an eye on in the future.
I have written it down, and I want to thank all of the listeners today and Reverend Bougeau for being with us. I thank you so much. Our hour has gone and come. It has flown by, and we have yet another hour of energy added to the field toward the Summer of Peace Global Attunement Event, September 21st. Stay with us, listeners, in this series, and thank you again for joining us. We say goodbye to you, dear Cynthia.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to join such a noble enterprise.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia. And let me just add to listeners, and thank you, Myra, beautiful conversation there, and thank you, Cynthia. We have one other feature I just want to remind listeners about, which is during the week following these calls, we upload the meditation part of the call onto our Global Care Room, which is the internet site created by the Institute of Heart Math that has a spinning Google Earth map on it, where when you log into the room, your location shows up as a point of light. And there's a place there for an audio player to upload the meditation, so you can be in the room with others around the world and listen to the meditation that we just heard today anytime for the next week, and then we upload the meditation for the following guest speaker. So just as a reminder about that, and also if folks would like to learn more about the Global Attunement event, then they can just visit www.gaiafield.net. Deep thanks for everyone for this beautiful call, and we'll see you next time.